This is July 8th, 2012, and today I'm going to read and comment on a couple of articles about busyness, idleness, and wandering mind. I'll start with an article on the front page of the review section of the Sunday New York Times. I don't have the date here, unfortunately, but a recent edition of the Sunday Times, and it's under a column that a regular column they call Anxiety, and this one's by Tim Kreider. Tim Kreider is the author of We Learn Nothing, a collection of essays and cartoons. And this one, they give the title, The Busy Trap. So I'll do a fair amount of reading and then some commenting on it. If you live in America in the 21st century, you've probably had to listen to a lot of people tell you how busy they are. It's become the default response when you ask someone how they're doing. Busy. So busy. Crazy busy. It is, pretty obviously, a boast disguised as a complaint. And the stock response is a kind of congratulation. That's a good problem to have. Or, better than the opposite. Actually, there is something to be said for that when so many people are grinding on through months and months of unemployment. There's something to that. But I think he's right. It is often, if not always, a boast disguised as a complaint. Notice, he says, notice it isn't generally people pulling back-to-back shifts in the ICU or commuting by bus to three minimum wage jobs who tell you how busy they are. What those people are is not busy, but tired, exhausted, dead on their feet. It's almost always people whose lamented busyness is purely self-imposed. Work and obligations they've taken on voluntarily, classes and activities they've encouraged their kids to participate in, encourages in quotation marks. They're busy because of their own ambition or drive or anxiety. That's, I think, the more important one, because I think usually that kind of ambition and drive comes out of anxiety. Because they're addicted to busyness and dread what they might have to face in its absence. Yeah, it's all too often, I think it is just wanting to escape the void, escape the whole question of what we're doing here. As long as you can convince yourself that you're that important and that everything, every day is this high stakes productivity contest, then you don't have to ever stop and reflect on what the other side of all that may be. He goes on, almost everyone I know is busy. They feel anxious and guilty when they aren't either working or doing something to promote their work. They schedule in time with friends the way students with 4.0 grade point averages make sure to sign up for community service because it looks good on their college applications. I recently wrote a friend to ask if he wanted to do something this week, and he answered that he didn't have a lot of time, but if something was going on, to let him know, and maybe he could ditch work for a few hours. I wanted to clarify that my question had not been a preliminary heads up to some future invitation. This was the invitation. But his busyness was like some vast churning noise through which he was shouting out at me, and I gave up trying to shout back over it. Even children are busy now, scheduled down to the half hour with classes and extracurricular activities. They come home at the end of the day as tired as grown-ups. I'm going to be skipping around through this article because we don't have the time to to read every bit of it. All right. Give me a chance to to say the other side of all this. The present hysteria is not a necessary or inevitable condition of life. It's something we've chosen, if only by our acquiescence to it. Not long ago, I Skyped with a friend who was driven out of the city by high rent and now has an artist's residency in a small town in the south of France. I'm going to skip these next few sentences at how much more relaxed she is in her slower lifestyle, and then it picks up. What she had mistakenly assumed was her personality, driven, cranky, anxious, and sad, turned out to be a deformative effect of her environment. Let me just pause there. As I've said so often from this seat, you can't really separate mind and environment. That our environment very much affects our mind. This is a crucial thing to understand for certainly someone in Zen practice. It's the friends you associate with. These will very much affect your practice and your ability to stay on track. But more than just your friends, it is the environment. Are these wonderful lines in the text that we chant several times a week, Affirming Faith in Mind, where we say, for things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. That only in some abstract sense can we really pull apart mind and environment. It's not as if any of us wants to live like this any more than any one person wants to be part of a traffic jam or stadium trampling or the hierarchy of cruelty in high school. It's something we collectively force one another to do. Yeah, and I've heard commentators say that in terms of overscheduling one's kids, part of it is just this collective this anxiety that if you're not keeping your kid as heavily scheduled as other parents are keeping their kids, then you're not keeping up. You're somehow deficient, or your kid's going to lose. And then he goes back to understanding this fear of non-busyness. Busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness. Obviously, your life cannot possibly be silly or trivial or meaningless if you are so busy, completely booked, in demand every hour of the day. And then he discloses that about his own kind of lifestyle, that he, as a writer, he just writes for 4 or 5 hours a day, and then he does this and that, and enjoys himself and all. But then he says, but just in the last few months, I've insidiously started, because of professional obligations, to become busy. For the first time, I was able to tell people with a straight face that I was too busy to do this or that thing they wanted me to do. I could see why people enjoy this complaint. It makes you feel important, sought after, and put upon. Except that I actually hate being busy. Every morning my inbox was full of emails asking me to do things I did not want to do, or presenting me with problems that I now had to solve. I got more and more intolerable. It got more and more intolerable until finally I fled town to the undisclosed location, that's capital U, capital L, from which I'm writing this. Here I am largely unmolested by obligations. There is no TV. To check email, I have to drive to the library. I go a week at a time without seeing anyone I know. I've remembered about buttercups, stink bugs, and the stars. I read, and I'm finally getting some real writing done for the first time in months. It's hard to find anything to say about life without immersing yourself in the world, but it's also just about impossible to figure out what it might be or how best to say it without getting the hell out of it again. Getting the hell out of it again. This, I feel, is really what we can understand from this article is the important thing is finding a way to make time for silence in our lives, for sitting, to start with. He develops this a little more. Idleness is not just a vacation, an indulgence, or a vice. It is as indispensable to the brain as vitamin D is to the body. And deprived of it, we suffer a mental affliction as disfiguring as rickets. The space and quiet that idleness provides is a necessary condition for standing back from life and seeing it whole, for making unexpected connections and waiting for the wild summer lightning strikes of inspiration. It is paradoxically necessary to getting any work done. Archimedes' Eureka in the bathtub, Newton's apple, Jekyll and Hyde, and the benzene ring. History is full of stories of inspiration that come in idle moments and dreams. It almost makes you wonder whether loafers, gold bricks, and no accounts aren't responsible for more of the world's great ideas, inventions, and masterpieces than the hard-working. There is much in this article that I think is insightful and good, but he makes the mistake, as I see it, he makes the mistake of one extreme or the other, that either you're driving yourself relentlessly and packing every minute of your day with activity on the one hand, or you're just loafing and idling around and doing nothing. And I don't think that's a fair choice to have to make. What we need is to find stillness in activity. What does that mean? How can we do that? Well, three guesses, the first two don't count. By developing a practice of daily meditation. And by meditation, I always mean not just the sitting, although that's essential, the sitting, but then extending into our daily life from the time we get up to the time we go to bed, extending this mind of stabilized awareness that is the very essence of the sitting. People who haven't done meditation will sometimes see it as a kind of a purposeless and indolent, a lazy kind of activity and self-absorbed. What are you doing to help other people? You're sitting there just looking into your own mind. This is a real misunderstanding because it is by unplugging the mind from the usual restless grasping that we so fills up so much of our lives. It's from unplugging from that grasping activity that we can see through the neurosis that prompts so much of that activity. Ever since Alexis de Tocqueville did his great commentary, wrote his commentary on Americans people have recognized how extremely restless Americans are, and how uncomfortable we are with non-activity. But it is the other side of activity. It's what gives sense to the activity. Or as he says himself very well here, the space and quiet that idleness provides is a necessary condition for standing back from life and seeing it whole. And then even the rest about the insights that can come to us when we're not rushing around in activity and grasping at something self-serving or profitable for ourselves. I'll finish up his article here. This is the last paragraph. Perhaps the world would soon slide to ruin if everyone behaved as I do. But I would suggest that an ideal human life lies somewhere between my own defiant indolence and the rest of the world's endless, frenetic hustle. My role, I think he's, by saying the rest of the world, I think he's doing injustice to the rest of the world. It's largely a modern industrial kind of phenomenon. My role is just to be a bad influence. The kid standing outside the classroom window making faces at you at your desk, urging you to just this once, make some excuse and get out of there, come outside and play. My own resolute idleness has mostly been a luxury rather than a virtue, but I did make a conscious decision a long time ago to choose time over money. Since I've always understood that the best investment of my limited time on earth was to spend it with people I love. I suppose it's possible I'll lie on my deathbed regretting that I didn't work harder and say everything I had to say. But I think what I really wish is that I could have one more beer with Chris, another long talk with Megan, one last good hard laugh with Boyd. Life is too short to be busy. This guy is clearly not someone who has come face to face with the, as Zen Master Dogen put, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. The fact that we do have, yes, a limited amount of time on this planet, and that, well, we're like a, our condition, the human condition, is like a pond with a fish. We're like fish in a pond that is being constantly drained. For whom does the bell toll? I came across these words of E.B. White, which I bet this author of this article I just read might appreciate. He said, "I arise in the morning between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." As anyone knows, certainly who's been to Sesshin, the Zen masters hammered away at the importance of using this opportunity that we've been given of having a human body mind. It's said in Buddhism that it is only from the human condition that we have the opportunity to come to awakening, to realize our nature, the nature of reality, to understand what we're doing here. Animals, so far as we know, don't have this ability to reflect. They don't have self-consciousness. And so they're not burdened with the question, existential questions of what to do, because they don't have any knowledge of their eventual death. We do have that burden of the awareness of our mortality. But with it comes this unbelievable opportunity to come to enlightenment. And that doesn't just come to us by luck. It requires work. Milarepa, the great Tibetan master of centuries ago, put it this way: affairs and business will drag on forever, so lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? Master in another tradition, I think this maybe was Ramakrishna of the Hindu tradition, said to have the extraordinary fortune of being born a human being and not to come to self-realization is to have lived in vain. Well, I think that's going too far, because a life of practice is by no means a life in vain, because the practice, the daily practice, purifies us. It purifies our karma, the karma that obstructs our realization. And dedicating ourselves to daily practice places us in a position to come to self-realization. We get much closer to it. And we get no closer to it when we are just allowing the mind to run in all directions and waste it. That's the word I'm going to use. Waste our time by living in daydreams. One of the two of the things that I didn't read from here is where he is, the author is making the case that a wandering mind is a way in which it enables us to come up with creative solutions to problems. And in fact, I ran across in my a collection of articles, one that shows some research that I think the name of the article is "The Virtues of a Wandering Mind." And I always read these articles. Well, I've only seen a couple of them, that one and another one. I read them with very keen interest, because just intuitively we know that letting the mind wander is not just an absolute negative thing, that there are things that can come out of it, but what is not going to come out of it a wandering mind is awakening. The precondition for awakening is a mind that is steady and grounded and clear, open, expansive, not a mind that is crisscrossed with random, irrelevant thoughts. There was a report in the New York Times about a study. That's the one I just mentioned, The Virtues of a Wandering Mind. But 6 months later, in the New York Times, there was one another study that reported the opposite. And I'm going to read from that one. This is from November of 2010. And the title of the article is When the Mind Wanders, Happiness Also Strays. And it begins very enticingly. It says, a quick experiment. This is by John Tierney. A quick experiment. Before proceeding to the next paragraph, let your mind wander wherever it wants to go. Close your eyes for a few seconds, starting now. And now, welcome back for the hypothesis of our experiment. Wherever your mind went, the South Seas, your job, your lunch, your unpaid bills, that daydreaming is not likely to make you as happy as focusing intensely on the rest of this column will. I'm not sure I believe this prediction, but I can assure you it is based on an enormous amount of daydreaming cataloged in the current issue of Science magazine. Using an iPhone app called Track Your Happiness, psychologists at Harvard contacted people around the world at random intervals to ask how they were feeling, what they were doing, and what they were thinking. The least surprising finding, based on 250,000 responses from more than 2,200 people, was that the happiest people in the world were the ones in the midst of enjoying sex. Or at least they were enjoying it until the iPhone interrupted. The researchers are not sure how many of them stopped to pick up the phone and how many waited until afterward to respond. Nor, unfortunately, is there any way to gauge what thoughts, happy, unhappy, murderous, went through their partners' minds when they tried to resume. When asked to rate their feelings on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being very good, the people having sex gave an average rating of 90. That was a good 15 points higher than the next best activity, exercising, which was followed closely by conversation, listening to music, taking a walk, eating, praying and meditating, cooking, shopping, taking care of one's children, and reading. Near the bottom of the list were personal grooming, commuting, and working. On average, throughout all the 250,000 responses, minds were wandering 47% of the time. I would submit that it's probably closer to 100. Minds are wandering 47% of the time. That figure surprised the researchers, Matthew Killingsworth and Daniel Gilbert. And then Gilbert says, I find it kind of weird now to look down a crowded street and realize that half the people aren't really there. I think this is a very telling statement. And it's not half. It's much more than that. I'm absolutely convinced that most people, throughout their waking hours, are not there. Meaning, whatever they're doing, their mind is somewhere else. This is the human affliction. Being split. Doing one thing, and having the mind somewhere else. The article continues, you might suppose that if people's minds wander while they're having fun, then those stray thoughts are liable to be about something pleasant. and that was indeed the case with those happy campers having sex. But for the other 99.5% of the people, there is no correlation between the joy of the activity and the pleasantness of their thoughts. And then this one of these two researchers, Matthew Killingsworth, says, even if you're doing something that's really enjoyable, that doesn't seem to protect against negative thoughts. The rate of mind wandering is lower for more enjoyable activities, but when people wander, they are just as likely to wander toward negative thoughts. And then the author says, whatever people are doing, whether it was having sex or reading or shopping, they tended to be happier if they focused on the activity instead of thinking about something else. Duh! I said yesterday in a moment of disinhibition at the workshop, I said, you want to know what the secret of life is? It's this. Just be one with whatever it is you're doing. And I don't even feel sheepish about calling that the secret of life anymore, because it is. If you want to be happy, don't be separated from what you're doing. Don't have your mind somewhere else other than what you're doing. It's really pretty simple. Not easy. Not easy. But it's uncomplicated. Become one with what you're doing, where you are at the moment. That's it. This is not rocket science. And then the author continues, whatever people were doing, oh, I just read that. And then he says, in fact, whether and where their minds wandered was a better predictor of happiness than what they were doing. And then Gilbert says, if you ask people to imagine winning the lottery, they typically talk about the things they would do. I'd go to Italy, I'd buy a boat, I'd lie on the beach, and they rarely mention the things they would think. But our data suggests that the location of the body is much less important than the location of the mind, and that the former has surprisingly little influence on the latter. That is, the location of the body has very little influence on the mind. The heart goes where the head takes it, and neither cares much about the whereabouts of the feet. Well, this is the premise of meditation, not just Zen, but any kind of meditation. This is the very premise of it, is that our experience of life is determined by the mind. More specifically, by how we use our attention, whether we allow our attention to flit around in all directions all the time and be apart from what we're doing, or whether we use our attention to be fully present. That's the premise of meditation. It's not just what you're doing or where you are or the circumstances of your life or the conditions. It's not just the weather, the heat, the cold. It's not whether you're at work or whether you're at the beach. It's the mind. It's all the mind. Who of anyone who believed this would not do meditation, would not have a daily practice of meditation? It changes everything. It determines everything about our experience. It determines the quality of our relationships, the quality of our work, the quality of our free time. Then he says, still, even if people are less happy when their minds wander, which causes which? Could the mind wandering be a consequence rather than a cause of unhappiness? And then he talked about a subsequent experiment that I won't get into the details of, but the results are as follows. We see evidence for mind wandering causing unhappiness, but no evidence for unhappiness causing mind wandering, Mr. Killingsworth says. So this would not be news to anyone of any of the certainly any of the mystical traditions of various religions, Zen or Christian mysticism or Sufism as the sort of the mystical sect of Islam. But this ability to be one with the moment, the circumstances we're in, and enjoy what psychologists now often call flow, being in the zone or being in this flow condition, this is not just good luck. This takes work. Going back to the first article I read from, it takes discipline, self-discipline and perseverance, a daily practice of getting to the mat and training the mind to be one with. Then the author writes, alternatively, you could interpret the iPhone data as support for the philosophical dictum of Bobby McFerrin, don't worry, be happy. The unhappiness produced by mind wandering was largely a result of the episodes involving unpleasant topics. Such stray thoughts made people more miserable than commuting or working or any other activity. But the people having stray thoughts on neutral topics ranked only a little below the overall average in happiness. And the ones daydreaming about pleasant topics were actually a bit above the average, although not quite as happy as the people whose minds were not wandering. Over the several months of the iPhone study, though, the more frequent mind wanderers remained less happy than the rest, and the moral seems to be, you stray, you pay. I gotta remember that one. So, at the risk of repeating myself, just that first article, it's like he was close but no cigar. His recognition of the neurotic components to frenetic activity is, I think, valuable. This is something that we can all consider. This doesn't mean that if you're busy, there's something neurotic about it. No. This phrase, workaholics, this is one that can be seen as a kind of a rationalization for people who prefer idleness. But it's good as practitioners, as those of us who are wanting to turn the mind around and look into what might be behind our activity, it's good to consider what we might think is noble, that there might be some neurotic element to it, some ego-based element to it. This is also practice, is being watchful, noticing when we take pride in something about ourselves, and having the presence of mind to catch ourselves when we're doing that, and just stop, and there's that important word, stop, and consider what we're missing. Because we tend to miss the stuff, the motivations that are ego-based. And they can be very subtle, as anyone knows who's been practicing for very long. In other words, to not get stuck in positive self-referential conclusions, whether it's because we're always busy or because we're not so busy and we love enjoying cafes and beaches and so forth, but to have the awareness, the self-awareness to question at times what's behind what we're doing or not doing. This is something that comes naturally. It's not like it doesn't require pondering or meditating on our behavior or our habits. But this, just these things, especially when we're sitting, these things just reveal themselves naturally. We just get a different perspective on things. This is what one of the things that's so trying about sesshin or other extended periods of meditation is that we get a new look at ourselves and the way our minds work and our habits, and see that it's never either all good or all bad. It can be much more complicated than that. But we have to find time to sit every day. We have to. Sitting is not just another activity to compete with spending time surfing the web, to compete with idle activity of lying around, reading novels, or working, or spending time with one's family. It's not just another activity. It is the basis of all activity. It is the ground, this wonderful realm of Zazen that can't be considered either activity or non-activity. How can it be considered non-activity? It involves effort. It's not an effort that is the same as straining or flogging oneself, but it does involve effort. Hakuin, the great Zen master whose chant and praise of Zazen that we recited at the big spirit before Teisho started, Hakuin famously said, "Should you desire the great tranquility, capital G, capital T, prepare to sweat white beads." And all of the masters and all the traditions have said this takes effort. Saint Teresa of Avila, addressing her nuns, said, "Strive like men until you die, for you are here for no other purpose than to strive." We can go too far in that direction too. That too can be straining. It can be grasping towards some goal. And as our practice matures, it all becomes less obvious. The whole matter of effort and striving sort of gets elusive, and we realize that the real pure effort doesn't have this self-conscious grasping or straining for something, enlightenment or some other goal. Our practice matures, we come to appreciate the importance of the element of relaxing in Zazen. When we start, we're trying to so hard to do everything right and do a good job of it, and so we can feel good about ourselves. And then as the practice matures, we learn that kind of striving doesn't bring the best results, that there is an element of I don't know that relaxing is the best word. It sort of implies leaning back, but maybe an element of settling down. The word relaxing can itself become an attachment. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.